next speaker is Ed Biting, and he's going to talk about investigations of anomalous heat in the nickel system. He also says he needs all of his time, and so we'll ask him to help to speak through this so we have time for lunch.
For a break, anyway. I'd like to start off by saying I've been going to conferences and participating in conferences for about 40 years, and this is the organization of this conference is right up there with the best. So I think Steve Patinsky and Dave Nagel deserve some kudos for taking care of all of this. I'm new to this community. Some of you know me, most of you don't. I'm an experimental physicist. I've been done research for about 45 years in the area of what's usually called OAMP, optical atomic molecular plasma physics. About 15 years of that has been done in the academic environment at various universities, but the last 30 years has been in the research labs of the Aerospace Corporation. The Aerospace Corporation is a nonprofit corporation incorporated in California, and its headquarters are located in the Los Angeles area. It's often described as a think tank for all areas of space technology. Our customers are all the domestic space agencies and all the prime contractors, but we also have quite a few international customers. And in order to support those customers, we have about 10% of the corporation resources are in a research lab, and that's where I spent my time. The data I'm going to present today, I will say, is a reproduction data in a skeptical environment, and is was planned about a half a dozen years ago. So, to a certain extent, it has historical. It's more historical than current. All the data I'm going to present is presented in detail in a 30-page report that's listed on the bottom of the slide. You can get this report by emailing the library at the Aerospace Corporation and referencing that number, or you can email me at that email and I will send you a copy. So I'm not going to go dwell on details. The report is quite readable because most of the details are in 9 appendices, so you can go through it pretty quickly. Let's see if this thing works. Good. So this is basically the outline I'm going to go through. I'll start a few minutes on motivation and the environment that I'm in. Then we're going to look at the manifestation that I used, which I call the Arata Ahern manifestation. And then we'll talk about the aerospace experiment that I did. let's see if I can do this right here. Okay. So here's the interest in my community. I've spent about 20 years developing technology of electric propulsion. And so when I became aware of the work that had been done back then, a half a dozen years ago, about 20 years work, I was actually quite surprised. And I thought it had a tremendous opportunity to revolutionize the space technology business. And I thought the easiest way that this could happen was using a gas phase manifestation, which is easier to use on orbit. And it would be a very easy drop-in replacement for RTDs, RTGs, which are radioisotope thermal generators, especially because NASA Glenn had spent about 20 years developing a high-efficiency thermal Stirling engine for that, which is purported to have about a 20-year on-orbit lifetime. So it looked like a really easy drop-in, and if the technology could be ready, I could possibly convince the powers that be at management, which was a skeptical environment, that it was worth investing some money in. That's my motivation. Electric propulsion has become very popular, especially in geosync satellites of recent, because, in fact, most geosync satellites today are launched with electric propulsion. And it's primarily because the power of the buses has gone up. It's not unusual to have 20 kilowatt power buses on these that can run 5 kilowatt plasma thrusters, two of them simultaneously. If the power density, if we could get 100 kilowatts on power without huge solar panels, it would just revolutionize the electric propulsion world and the satellite technology. And that was my interest and my corporation's interest. Now, the environment I'm working in is, most of all the research in the research labs is externally funded. We have a limited internal R&D budget. It's typically something like a half manpower for a couple of years. So in choosing an experiment in a skeptical environment, I basically had one shot at it. It had to be pretty simple. And so I built in three criteria that I wanted for this, that it had to basically be simple to imitate, high probability of success, that it had to be reproducible by an independent person at least once. And to be simple, I wanted something simple triggering, no lasers and plasmas. Thermal triggering would be the best way to do it. So what I chose was, at the time this was conceived, which is about 6 years ago, the only data I saw out there that met this was the errata method that was developed in Japan, and it's been carried forward elegantly and beautifully by the Technova presentations that you saw yesterday. And it was duplicated in 2003, the Brian Ahern EPRIC report. And Brian was very helpful in me preparing the material for this. It was the simplest experimental implementation, and it had, I believe, a high probability of success, so I could see it first time. Sample preparation was very similar to what you saw discussed yesterday at the Technova presentations. The base material was a metal ribbon prepared by Ames Research Labs. It was basically 2/3 zirconium, 1/3 nickel, and about 3% palladium. I processed that locally, heated it at 440°C for 28 hours to oxidize it. I then ground it up with a mixmaster to particle sizes of 3 to 5 microns. And then, that was my base material, my active material. Then I did something that was different from what was done in the two previous implementations of this, because it was so much talk in the literature about the effects of magnetic field on this process, I decided to mix in some magnetic particles. So I looked at rare earth magnets that had high magnetic fields. I chose samarium cobalt magnets for reasons you can read about in the report. By the way, I cannot present anything today that's not in the report. The good news is the report has all the detail I know, so I can't really do it. But images that I have to report or have to use today are in their report. So you can see various stages of the processing of the material in this slide. So there were two experiments done. The first one I call a practice learning experiment. Both experiments used two cells. One was a control cell and one was the active cell. Each cell was a 10-centimeter stainless steel vessel that was held with a long stainless steel rod that tried to be as thermally isolated as possible. It was encased in a vacuum. I'll show you in a minute. But the first practice run, in both cells I put 10 grams of the active material, but in the second cell I added 10 grams of the magnetic samarium cobalt magnet materials to it. And both cells were loaded with deuterium gas in this. The results of this are not in the main body of the part. They're in the report. They're in the first appendix. I'm not going to go into that at all. I don't feel like I can rigorously defend it because of a lot of issues that I corrected in the second data run. But the important thing is that I saw excess heat in both of them, but I saw significantly more excess heat with the cell with the particles in it. So in the main run, I included magnetic particles in it, which is the main difference between the Errata and the Ahern experiments. This shows you the architecture. The cell was supported by a thin stainless steel tube. It was inside a vacuum jacket to isolate it from the environment. As I said, the cell was wound with heating wire, nichrome wire in this case. In the main experiment, the two cells had exactly the same material in it. And the test cell was pressurized with hydrogen, and the reference cell was pressurized with nitrogen. The power in, the pressure, and the temperature were recorded, and the power was inferred from calibration curves, which I'll talk about in a second. All measurements were computer controlled 24/7. Measurements were taken every 30 seconds. This shows you a picture of the apparatus before submitted in, before put in the vacuum jacket. You can see on the top left the thermocouples, which were type K thermocouples with refractory coatings that were put in the cells, and then they were loaded with materials. We had some really fancy equipment in aerospace where we could do X-ray tomography of the cells before, after they were loaded. I did this in order to ensure that the cells were uniform and the thermocouples were away from the walls and separated and surrounded by materials, which you can see in the bottom two images. There's a lot more images in the report. This is basically a breakdown of the cell contents. It's in the report, you can look at it. But basically, there were 20 grams of active material in each cell and about 6 grams of the samarium cobalt magnets. This chart actually shows the oxygen that was absorbed during the oxygenation process, the oxidation process. This shows the experimental setup. The cells were connected to a vacuum system, which had an oil-free turbo pump that could be used to evacuate it. It had both pressure transducers and Bourdon gauges that it could read out the pressure in either cell. They could be pressurized with either hydrogen or nitrogen through the gas manifold. It was all controlled by one computer. All the instrumentations were uninterruptible power supplies because the test ran for more than 2 months, and we had numerous power interruptions that couldn't be allowed during the measurement. Okay, here is the experimental timeline that we used. Basically, the period of the whole experiment was 67 days. It included a cell bakeout at temperatures between 150 and 350 degrees under vacuum to basically remove water. Then there was a 6-day calibration period. Calibration was done under two gas conditions. One was vacuum, evacuated, and the other was 1 bar of nitrogen in both cells. And that period went between up to 300 degrees C. There was a gas loading period that lasted 2 days. There was the heating triggering period, which lasted 4 days. And then there was a 42-day period, which I ran it at constant temperature and power to measure the excess, any excess power, if there was any. And then there was a 13-day step-down period. This shows the calibration curves. There should be 8 curves there, one for each thermocouple in 2 cells with 4 different 2 different pressures. But the calibration curves for the 2 different thermocouples in the same cell lay right on top of each other. So effectively, there are just 4 different calibration curves. The sensitivity of the device is about 12.5 degree change for every watt of power change. So this is, I'll show you just a couple of data slides here. There are many data slides in the report. This data slide is a 50-hour period showing the pressurization. The top graph is cell one that was hydrogen pressurized. The bottom cell is the nitrogen pressurization. And both were pressurized to about 4.5 bar absolute. There was a slight absorption by the material of nitrogen, which basically stopped, which you'll see in the next slide, which is a 1,000-hour period. The interesting, so what you see here is both the temperature and the pressure curves on here. The interesting one is the top curve. When the hydrogen is first loaded in, this is light hydrogen, there is the exothermic H2 absorption, which is a chemical reaction. It jumped from room temperature, 23 degrees, to 48 degrees, a difference of 25 degrees C. If you integrate the energy underneath that pipe curve, it's about a kilojoule. It's 1,120 joules of energy. It comes right back down. If you look at the black curves, which are the pressure curves, the hydrogen starts off at about 4.5 bars. It drops to a couple of bars. I repressurize it. It drops again. I repressurize it a third time, 4 bars. It drops again. And then after another 24 hours of dropping, I normalize the pressure in both cells to approximately 1 bar before I go to the next stage. Now, I'm going to apologize for the next slide because it's a bit busy. It's designed for the report, which has a lot of verbiage explaining all the detail on it. But basically, on each of the curves, will be each of the graphs will be 5 curves. And the two important ones are the top ones, the light red and the light green, which represent the excess power. So what you're looking here at is at a 1,000 hours of data, basically 42 days of data. The top curve that you see is the temperature divided by 200 on this scale. The temperature in that range is between about 293 to 295 degrees centigrade, so just under 300 degrees centigrade, held constant. The power is constant over this period. The third curves down are the excess power curves. There are two of them there. There's a red and a green. I'll explain that in a second. That curve height represents an excess power of about 1 watt for an input power of about 12 watts, or about 7.5% excess power. The error on that 1 watt is about 5%, plus or minus 5%. The top curve, as I said, is cell one with the hydrogen in it. The bottom sets of curves are the second cell with the nitrogen in it. I think the top cell is the hydrogen. And you can see the red curve at the bottom hugs the zero line, which is the excess power that's measured in the control cell. That number is a little bit above the zero line by about 50 milliwatts, 0.05 watts. To be very conservative in estimating the excess power of the top cell, I subtracted that 0.05 watts from it, which is the green curve that you see at the top. So this is the result slide. And what I did is, during a 950-hour period, a 40-day integration period, I integrated all the power to get the total energy. For the nitrogen cell, the integrated power gave me about a tenth of a megajoule. For the hydrogen cell, I integrated that power and subtracted that tenth of a megajoule to get a total power of 3.5 megajoules. Estimated error is plus or minus 6% on that. If I normalize that to the mass to get the specific energy, if I normalize to the total mass, the total 20 grams, including the zirconium oxide, I get a specific energy of 173 megajoules per kilogram. If I normalize it just to what is believed the active material, which is the nickel and the palladium, I get a specific energy density of 635 megajoules per kilogram. For reference, the highest hydrocarbon fuel listed is methane, is about one-tenth of that, 55 megajoules per kilogram. The highest record chemical energy I could find was highly compressed hydrogen. I think it was 120 bar or something. Came out to 142 megajoules per chemical per kilogram. That was for the 40-day integration period. It followed a 13-day power down period. I'm not going to say much about that now because there's not time. It's all in the report. The excess power for the H2 cell went down as the power went down. It looked like a credible thing. So the takeaway from the slide is that the excess energy, to my eye, looks like it can't be of chemical origin. And so I consider that I had basically verified the results of errata and of Ahern that was previously done. So I go through the strengths and the weaknesses of this. Let me just speak a minute or two for the weaknesses. I think the main weakness is that I did use thermometry instead of calorimetry. Calorimetry is the right way to do it. Since I left, retired from aerospace about 3 years ago, I have now built a lab and developed the technology to do it right using calorimetry. Not as good as the Technova guys. These guys are great, doing great work, and I love it. The other big problem I have with this, or weakness, would be the fact that the thermocouples are embedded in the material. And even though I coated the material to try to keep interaction out with it, this work was vetted through a lot of people. I have about 3 minutes, I think. Vetted by a lot of people. Probably the most interesting one is, in order to get some follow-on funding, I presented this material to the Jason Group, who consisted of Richard Garwin and William Happer at Princeton University. And they came out with the most interesting criticism of it that I hadn't considered. And Will Happer told me that type K thermocouples in reducing atmospheres and hydrogen atmospheres actually gave erroneous measurements, which I didn't know about. And I said, well, they're coated with a refractory. And he said, well, it could penetrate this refractory. In fact, Darwin suggested an experiment I could do to see if that was a problem. However, on investigation of this process, it's actually called green rot, I believe, in the literature. It only occurs above 600 or 700 degrees C, something you should consider if you're using a type K thermocouple in a reducing atmosphere. But when it does happen, it actually lowers the indicated temperature, which would make my measurements even more conservative if they were true. So I'm going to say just one word on the believability of the results. As I said, these were presented to my management, which is a skeptical environment. Were they believed? I think the people who were really not inundated and brought up my level of seeing the whole Pounds, Fleshman, and Broglio in the late 80s were actually accepted the results. If they were, it was an amazing situation. They wouldn't even, you know, we'd just say, I don't believe it, or they wouldn't even look at the results. I stayed away from social sciences just so because in physics you have a real arbiter. You just go to the lab, and people don't accept the lab results. I don't know what you do. So it made me try to study psychology a little bit, and I came up with two very well noted studies in psychology, and one's called confirmation bias, which leads to cognitive dissonance. And the two working together just short-circuit critical thinking. And we all have primate brains, and we're all susceptible to this. And we all have to be careful about it, so be aware of it. I think Tom Darden's opening talk was very insightful along these ways, and I think we should all be careful that we don't fall to that. And at that, I'll stop. And if you have any particular questions,
One quick question.
Quick question on the magnetic additions that you put into the cell. Was that the one you discussed here, or was that a different test?
That was what was discussed here, the met.
Okay.
Yes.
A quick question. Nitrogen versus hydrogen, they have different thermal conductivities, different conductive heat transfer. What do you have?
Yeah, good question. Well, it turns out that I used the calibration curves for vacuum for the, I didn't have the time to say it, but if you looked at the pressure curves for the measurements, the pressure and the hydrogen test cell went to zero, so it was basically vacuum. It was all absorbed. It was less than a 20th of an atmosphere. However, the nitrogen stayed at the calibration pressure, and so that curve was used for that cell, and the vacuum curve was used for the other cell.
Okay, I think there's another question, but I suggest let's do that with a cup of
coffee
in our hand outside.
Dave,
first of all, I'd like to thank all of our presenters this morning, five presenters, and I think all of them were excellent.